I'm Amy.
I'm Wendell.
And I'm Patrick.
And
this is
Yes
But Why
Podcast.
So one, we were just talking about, you know, people, students don't totally understand that, like, it's not just like Improv 1 to SNL, and that can be a problem. Something else that occurred to me recently was that it's not like you do one project or that you even have one community that you're a part of. Like,
yeah.
You move and things happen and you make new friends and you do different things and all of it's okay. Like, I don't know.
I think even that varies from person to person, because I do, when I was younger, I was very envious of those people that just knew what they wanted to do. And I think there are people, there are artists that they know from like childhood, this is what I'm going to do. And they are part of one community because that's what they're going to do. They're ballet dancers or they're painters or whatever. They change and they grow, but there's never any deviation because that's the thing they're supposed to do. I think a lot of people in improv are more like general utility artists. You know, they're people who are creative. They have a voice. They want to express themselves. But I think a lot of people are not as they're not as predetermined about what that medium is going to be. And particularly when you get in the general area of comedy, obviously there's a lot of different ways you can express that. And those feel differently, and there's different things that are better expressed in different mediums. But I think you're absolutely right that people think there is a path.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, there's your path, and we don't know what it is yet. And even stuff, and this is the other thing that I think is like, I really notice a lot. This culture has gotten so product-oriented and so results-oriented that people will like spend a fairly minimal amount of time on something that doesn't pan out immediately and feel like that was a failure. And I'm like,
oh yeah,
I did stuff when I was younger that I thought, that was a failure, that was a terrible idea. And literally 10, 15, 20 years later, I'm like, oh, that's why I did that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't know. You are not smart enough to know. Nobody is. Nobody is smart enough to know what is going to contribute to your growth as an artist, you know?
So. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. I have a sketch show that I've been doing, and it's like 8 years old now.
Mm-hmm.
So I've put in a lot of time.
Yeah.
But now that I have the baby, my life is very different, and I'm starting to have to, like, I can't do as much, and I'm like, what can I dedicate my time to?
Yeah.
And sometimes I think, and occasionally, sorry, audience, you're going to hear this, but occasionally I'm like, I got to stop doing that show.
Oh, yeah.
It's like so much. And I'm like, I've tried to do it without me. Like, I've tried to make other people handle it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, it's not the same thing. Because it's, you know, it's, I'm the engine of this thing.
But that's,
and so
another,
it's wild.
That's another trap, is that you are comparing what you're able to do now to the way you always did it.
Yeah.
And in this case, there's a very obvious thing that changed. But I think what people miss often is, like, your circumstances change. You're not the same person you were. Stop using the same standards for what you're doing that you had even a year ago. You're a different person now. It's like, well, I did that before, so, and it worked. It's like, yeah, that was then. So it's like, that's not an appropriate level for you to be engaged now. You got to find a different way to engage with this stuff.
Right, right. Plus, it's interesting to have a different, like, way of going into it. Like,
mm-hmm.
I've talked about this before, but, like, since I'm pretty much doing, like, stay-at-home mom, I stare at this kid all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm, like, trying to do a character study of a baby. Like,
because
so I'm staring at, and I'm also thinking, like, what about motherhood should I be writing down, you know? Because
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of stuff that I realize, like, I passed through. Like, I talked to somebody the other day about how I don't remember what it's like to be single anymore because I've been married for a while.
Right.
So now when people talk about it, I'm like, I'm sure that's hard.
Yeah.
But, like, I don't remember.
Yeah.
I don't have the emotional connection to it. And I know that in a few years, having an emotional connection to, like, early motherhood, like, I'll be like, yeah, I guess it's fine. Whatever. But I'll be like, remember when it was, like, new and you were figuring it out? You know, that kind of stuff to remember.
But that, the way you just put that, I think is so relevant to improv anyway. It's like an empathetic putting yourself into a different situation and really not just with your brain, but with your whole body and existence. Like, what would that be like to be that person in that situation, right? And I do think in those examples you were talking about, yeah, you don't consciously know what it was like to be single. You don't consciously know what it's like to be single anymore.
Right.
But you did it. It's in you.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's still in there.
Yeah, yeah.
So that experience is not going to be lost. And the same thing with your kid. You know, yeah, you're not going to maybe consciously remember all those great observations you made, but it's in there. Like, you've got that. That's part of you now.
Yeah.
You've got that experience. So that's never. That's always going to inform whatever you're doing, regardless of whether you're consciously evoking it and, you know, trying to bring it up.
Yeah. Since we're discussing the idea of having this sort of, like, you know, hindsight is 20/20 scenario,
yeah.
Are there any, like, memories of your, like, the first or whatever experience that you might have that you have recently called upon as a, like, oh, now I'm reaping the lessons that I learned in that time? Is there anything, any particular time of your life that you've thought about recently or used in a class or something like that?
Wow, that's a really good question. Well, first off, I don't think hindsight is 20/20. I just think
it's better than
the sight you have with the... Because you never get to...
I've never had 20/20, so I don't actually understand what that even
means. Yeah, me neither. Yeah, hindsight is like glasses, but it's still not 20/20. Wow, that's a really good question.
If it's too deep, it's totally fine. We can move around it.
No, I mean, I think it touches on... Let me see if I can nutshell this. I think one of the biggest challenges of improv, and I think this is true of any art once you get up to a certain level in the art, but one of the biggest challenges of improv is that almost immediately you're confronted with your own shit. Like, you have to deal with who you are because it affects your improv.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's really difficult, because I do believe, like, if you're doing visual arts or like music or something, you can learn a lot of technical skills before you have to emotionally reveal yourself.
Yeah.
You can work on correct guitar fingering for a long time, and then one day you're like, I'm going to write a song, and then that's more vulnerable, but now you've mastered the technical stuff. Improv, it's all together. It all happens at the same time, right?
Yeah.
And the last couple of years, and this is going to sound political, but I really mean it from like a personal, emotional point of view. Last couple of years, as a straight white man, I have been just gobsmacked by how little I knew about what the world was like. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And this is like speaking as someone who considered myself to be liberal and also to be pretty well informed about the world. Right? And if you had asked me like 3 years ago, it's like, do African Americans have a harder time of it than Americans? Absolutely. Absolutely. And I could list to you the reasons, like, oh, redlining and economic, you know, I could tell you that. Do women have a harder time than men? Absolutely. Sexism is still rampant. Here's how. I thought I understood it. And the last couple of years, the combination of the information that's come out of, you know, primarily Black Lives Matter and then Me Too and all the associated consciousness raising movements, right? I've been like, holy shit. I had no idea. And it's caused me to go back and look at my own behavior over the years, and it's horrifying. And fortunately, I've gone through enough therapy that I don't turn that into, oh, I'm a bad person, I deserve to suffer. But it's painful. It is painful to look back on my own behavior and go, that was, you know, I don't even want to think about it. But I was doing the best I could at the time.
Yeah.
And that, to me, if I'm willing, and I'm not saying I've succeeded in this, but to the extent I'm willing to take that insight on stage, that's useful. You know what I mean? I think that is an advantage that artists have that other people don't have, is when you have these really painful things that you're not going to be able to resolve. I can't go back in time and fix the kind of person I was.
Sure.
But I can deal with it on stage.
Sure.
I heard this story, and I'll leave out the names because I don't want to... It was told in a workshop, but it still feels pretty personal to me.
Sure.
But there's an improviser, and this is in a different city, so no one has to try to guess who it is here. there's an improviser, and his wife, I think she's an actor, but she's not an improviser.
and they were really struggling with an issue. I think it was they were trying to have a kid and it wasn't working, but it was some very painful, very personal issue they were struggling with. And the improviser was talking to an improv friend of his and talking about how hard it was for his wife. And he said, imagine not being able to improvise about that. You know what I mean? Like, she, you know, he was like, I can at least come do this. I can express that this way, right?
Yeah.
So that to me, like, that's the advantage. Even if you're, I don't consider myself to be a great artist. Like, I aspire to be one. I don't think I am. I think I'm competent. But the advantage of being in the arts is that when you got shit you want to deal with, you have an outlet. And that is huge.
I actually really think that it's sort of a natural ability that is born of people that are inclined to this kind of thing, that there's sort of an empathy and a more open-hearted, because you have to, in order to put into your life that you're going to see other people's point of views from their point of view,
yeah,
you have to be very open. And so I think
to do people, it well,
people yeah. who are trying to be actors. I mean, you know, think of every person you and I have ever known that have gone to grad school for acting, mm-hmm. or have been working in theaters in any city, you know, like on stage every night for 40 weeks or whatever that means for them.
Mm-hmm.
That idea, the idea of improvising, I think there is something to having it. And I think the thing that I actually think is crazy, and I will make it political, is that I think that unfortunately it means that we are the only ones that are truly going to be able to digest the world changing and be able to look inward and try to change ourselves in a way that feels good. Because when you're doing improv and we're doing acting, you're open to change. Like, we're even what we were just talking about at the very top, when we were talking about how it's like, I need to be open to the fact that, like, my life is different now, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. And so when you move forward and you want to figure out, you know, some new way of looking at the world, like, oh man, I acted this way, now I'm going to be better. Even just having the wherewithal to say you will do that and try to do that, I think is a creative idea. And a lot of people don't have the ability.
Oh, yeah,
I think
a
that's a trouble with what's going on, is like, most people don't have this ability. We are lucky enough. I realize most of the people I talk to just have something that, like, makes them able to feel deeper. And it is a wild sort of connection to being able to digest the world around you and get through it. I don't know.
I agree with everything you just said with two minor qualifications. One, I don't think artists are the only people who do that. I think there are a lot of people who are doing that. I think particularly, well, people who've been in therapy, people who've gone through recovery, anyone who's had to kind of examine themselves and examine their relationship to the world.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of different forms I can take. I don't want to suggest those are the only two things. But I think there are people who are more naturally inclined to do it, and I think there are avenues other than the arts. So I do think there's some people that are a lot better at, I don't want to say better, they're a lot more open to other people's experiences.
Yeah.
The other qualification is, particularly in comedy, I think you have a lot of people that aren't interested in that. And this gets back.
Oh,
this gets back
to
you're talking about. You know what you were talking about in its most extreme form. That idea that, well, there's a path and it starts with level one and it ends with SNL.
Right.
That's about product.
Yep.
That's not about process. That's what. How can I move forward? And SNL to me is a great example. Obviously, there are a lot of brilliant performers on that show. I'm not trying to take anything away from it. I do think it's significant how many improvisers want to wind up on an SNL, a show that has no improv on it whatsoever.
Yeah.
And if you are trying
to... Well, I mean,
to,
let's be honest. They do sketch prov.
They do sketch prov,
that's
yeah.
That's what they're doing.
Whether they mean to or not.
Yeah, yeah. That's what's happening.
That's what's happening. But if you are being super results-oriented about it, then you might correctly assume that the best way to get an SNL is not to be a generous and open improviser and make yourself vulnerable on stage. It's to come up with some really good characters, mm-hmm. you know? And which is not to take anything away from that skill set, which is huge and which I don't have, which I admire a lot in other people. But that's different from what we're talking about, that empathy, that being present in the moment, that responding to what's going on, which to me is the heart of improv. So I think it's possible to become a very good performer without really going too deep into that other stuff. I think it limits how great you can be as a performer, but it certainly can make you good enough to you know, achieve something like that.
Yeah. I think you're right about the idea that, you know, there's a business path. I mean, there's a thousand paths, and that's my whole point. But that there are definitely people who will work real hard and do, you know, learn impressions and go to the right festivals and get themselves involved in whatever you need to get involved in and meet the right people to get on SNL. But then another thing we were talking about earlier is that it's just one job.
Yeah.
It's a job, and it's a job that will go however long, but it will end at some point, and then you need to do something else. So what's the trajectory like for you? Or at least, like, do you have the acceptance to try to get up and do another thing after that? I don't know.
Well, it is the weird thing about SNL's prominence in this world, because I understand why people focus on it, because it's like, well, if you want examples of people who started out as improvisers and got famous, that's the best example.
Yeah.
But it is. It's one show. You know? And it to me, it would make a lot more sense for someone to be, say, well, I want to be rich and famous. I'm like, well, that's reasonable. You know?
Sure.
And there's a lot of ways to do that.
Yeah. But I want to be Jerry Seinfeld. I want to be Ray Romano.
But
one
even
of those things.
Yeah. But I mean, just saying, okay, I want to do good work that a lot of people see. I want to be really popular. You know, those are all like comprehensible goals. But to say, make it specifically, I want to be on this particular show. There we go.
Yeah, it's a weird sort of obsession people have with the show. They're really very much into that idea. And what's funny, too, is it's, like, considered this, like, all-American, really. And I was like, the guy who runs it is Canadian. You're not even, you know what I mean? Like, it's not like it's this amazingly
By this point, it's pretty American. But
yeah, I mean, it's just, the funny thing about it is that it doesn't even, it's terrible hours and way too much work and I don't think a lot of money. So it's like, yeah, it's not really, you know, exactly what you should be looking for.
Well,
as far as a gig.
Unless you love those things. I mean, I do think there are a lot of
people. Unless you love those things. Yeah, you're sure.
But I mean, you know, there are people that they're happiest when they are under deadline and they've got to produce a bunch of stuff and they're in this hothouse environment. That, you know, that gives me nightmares. But I mean,
yeah.
But I think for
it
some
gives
people,
me too, that's clearly.
Yeah. If you really love that and say you're a writer, like, that makes sense to me. It's like, oh, I want to be up there and be forced to produce good stuff every week and be in a competitive environment. If that works for you, great. Fantastic. But I don't know. It just seems like a very narrow thing to shoot for. And now, particularly, it made a little more sense back when there was a monoculture and there were only three TV channels. It's like, yeah, you want to be on Saturday Night Live, that's the only way you're famous. Well, now you've got infinite ways that you could get your voice out to people, you know?
Yeah.
And some of them are more some of them reach more people than others. But you never know what's going to get noticed. I mean, nobody prior to the Lonely Island guys getting signed to Saturday Night Live, nobody would have said, oh yeah, doing that stuff on the internet is a great way to get on Saturday Night Live, you know, but they got noticed.
Well, there's been a lot of people that have done that path, you know, they've created their own YouTube buzz and done that. But then there's the argument that there's a lot of that a lot of the content that's out there in the world is just for the internet, and that you're based on, like, the number of likes you get and the number of followers. Whoa. And now it's like a weird thing. Part of me's like, you know, I mean, I agree that I would like people to like more of my things, and when they don't, I'm like, why not? But maybe who am I to fight what they like?
Well, but also, and this gets back to the weird thing about comedy, And it's always been interesting because I think improv understandably gets lumped in with other comedy, like stand-up comedy. But there's kind of an idea in stand-up, no matter how good you are, if you can't make a particular audience laugh at a particular time, you failed to a certain extent. And sure. And people will acknowledge that, oh, that was a rough audience or whatever. But that was your job, was to make this randomly assorted group of people laugh. I came to this from bands. I did music. Huh. And nobody would judge a band by taking a random group of people off the street and saying, hey, there's music in here. And then you have that band play for them. It's like, did you like that band? No, I guess they must suck. It's like a band is playing to people who like that kind of music. And yet with comedy, we're expected to go into a room. It's like, here's comedy, you know? So when we talk about likes on YouTube, I'm like, I don't know who liked it. Like, I'm more concerned with reaching people who like the kind of thing I like than just getting random, you know, getting numbers up.
Yeah.
And, you know, because there are ways to get more likes or more people to your show.
Yeah.
That don't have anything to do with what kind of stuff you're doing. And if you really don't care about what you're doing, you just want to get the maximum amount of exposure, whatever, there are ways to do that. But that just seems really unsatisfying to me. But
yeah.
Maybe that's what motivates some people. I don't know.
So you started out in bands, you say.
Yes.
How did that manifest itself? What kind of bands were you doing, and how did it end up in an improv theater?
Well, I was kind of a classic Austin slacker. Like, I had a series of jobs.
Are you from Austin?
No. I grew up in El Paso.
Right on.
Actually. But I went to boarding school here, and then I left town. I went to New York to flunk out of college, and then I came back here and worked, you know, a bunch of just kind of standard Austin jobs.
Sorry.
That's okay. I do that all the time. You know, so I worked at like Hut's Hamburgers, and I worked at Half Price Books, and I worked at Waterloo Records, and I worked at the Legislature, and I worked at the Statesman, and I worked at Texas Monthly, you know, just kind of
really living the Austin life.
Yeah. And you
soaked,
know,
it all
was,
in.
It was still cheap enough that you could kind of like not invest a whole lot of energy in what you were doing and still have fun. But I started playing bands around that time. And I wish I had, my personal issues were such that like I didn't have any faith in myself as a musician, so I didn't really commit to it. And I really wish I had committed to it. Because I think I had the potential to be a good musician, but I was so screwed up emotionally that I was not pursuing that. But the answer to how that affects improv is when I came to improv, I had this very clear sense of how people write exactly. Well, that's what I was going to say. But how people collaborate together in groups. And one of the things that really struck me, and I've talked with other people who came to improv and music, and we all have the same reaction, we get so mad when people don't show up for rehearsals. Because you can't do that in a band. You can't just say, I'm not going to show up.
Yeah.
Like, that is a big deal. You are letting down the other people in the band. And improv, you're like, oh, I can't make it. It's like, what?
Yeah.
We had rehearsals set up, you know? So, obviously, you can do it without that person in improv in a way that you can when you don't have the bass player or whatever. But I think, you know, being in that sort of instilled my belief. It's like, no, you show up for that. That's your commitment to the other people in your group. So it still drives me nuts. And as a coach, long ago, I wrote it into my agreement. It's like, okay, I'm gonna charge you an amount based on how many people are in your group. And that amount is the same. And I don't care how many people show up. I'm not just going to collect money from whoever showed up.
Yeah.
That's because that gives you impetus not to show up. You're going to pay me whether you show up or not. And if you're not interested in showing up for your own rehearsal, I'm not interested in coaching you, basically.
Yeah.
But.
So how did you get started in improv? How did you break out of the band situation and get yourself involved? Which theater, or I guess perhaps it was in the early days of Hideout, perhaps? I've heard that was the longest running. Where did you start?
Hideout was definitely the nexus of improv back then. So I started improv, and I think I was kind of seeking something, because I had just finished a stint where I was training as a yoga teacher, and then kind of dropped that. And then I had signed up for a friend of mine who's a really good painter here in town, Jennifer Balkin. I had signed up for her
figure drawing class, so I was clearly looking for something.
Man, you're the ideal student.
No. Oh, we'll get into that later, but no, I am not the ideal student. I'm terrible. But I was in a group, this kind of large, loose group that would go out like once every couple of months and get dim sum. And I knew some of the people in the group. I think I knew, maybe I knew Shannon McCormick. But Shannon Merlin was in that group. And I didn't know her at all. And we sat next to each other at dim sum once. And I was talking, I'm like, what are you doing? She's like, I teach improv. I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. And at that time, she was teaching at the state. It was part of the state theater acting school. And it was before she had started Marlin Works. But I signed up for a couple of levels of her class. And she was doing like John Stoney and stuff. So there was a lot of short form stuff and there was a lot of narrative stuff. Neither of which really, like, I liked it. It was fun, but I was like, nah, you know, this is okay. But then she found out I played piano. And Shana, of course, had founded the group Girls, 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 who do improvised musicals. She's like, oh my God, will you play music for us? So I started playing music for Girls, 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 and that was great. And the cool thing about that was I immediately had all this status in the improv world that I had not worked for. You know what I mean? Like, I was just like, oh, cool. I don't have to do the work. I just come in and play piano. So I was completely happy with that. And I was sort of hanging around that. So the Hideout was kind of the nexus of, that was the only improv theater in town at that time. And it was so, like, literally, it was one of those situations where people are sitting around the green room and there's, say, an 8 o'clock show and a 10 o'clock show. And at the 10 o'clock show, someone walks in and says, who wants to play the show? And everyone's like, I don't, you know. So there were maybe 50 improvisers in town, maybe 20 to 30 that hung around that theater a lot, right? So I was doing that. I was pretty happy. And then I saw on stage in rapid succession, I can't remember which came first, Tight, which was a forerunner of the Frank Mills. So that was three couples. Dave Buckman and Rachel Madorsky, Bob and Erica McNichol, and then a couple who are also kind of Chicago-trained, Aaron Plischke and Jen Cargill. And they were doing Chicago-style stuff. And I saw that, and I was like, oh, wait a minute. And then I saw Bob and Erica do a two-person show, and I was like, holy shit, I want to do that. What is that? And it was just one of those things where just the synapses fired. It's like, that's what I want to do. And I always feel bad telling that because it feels like I'm demeaning, you know, John Stoney and stuff. I'm not. I have a lot of respect for that, but it doesn't push my buttons the same way. And we've had people at Coal Town that do the exact same opposite thing. I had a group years ago, and they were all going into the next level. And they're like, man, we really want to do narrative. And I was kind of like, I'm not supposed to tell you this, but you guys need to go to the Hideout. Because no one's going to give you better training in that, and you're just going to be frustrated here, because that's not what we do here, you know? So I think it works both ways. But once I saw that, and that was right around the time Coal Town had just moved to town, the group had just moved to town, they were literally starting Coal Town Theater right then, and all those people I had just seen on stage were teaching there. And I was like, oh, okay, I got to do that. So I was in the second graduating class at Coal Town, and have been there ever since.
You are the conservatory director there now, huh?
I am.
How was the path to that? Was that always something you wanted to do, or did it happen upon, you know, it became available and you were like, you know what, this is something I'm interested in? How'd you get there?
It became available. I mean, I was the first, so the initial teaching staff of Coal Town was the Frank Mills and the group Coal Town. Mm-hmm. That was when they first started. I was the first teacher they hired after that, you know, once they were in motion. So I'd been teaching there the longest. I guess I had been thinking, it's like, oh, yeah, fire conservatory director. Cody Deering actually was the conservatory director right before me. And mm-hmm. there was some, you know, as always, when someone's in an authority position like that, you're like, nah, I would maybe have done that differently. But I hadn't, sure. I wasn't really, like, plotting it or anything. And This sort of countervailing instinct is that I had worked middle management before in other jobs, and I had vowed to myself I was never going to do middle management again. That is the worst. Middle management is the worst. You get it from both ends all the time.
Oh, my God, but now you're in theater middle management, which is fun.
Yeah, when Cody left,
I was like, and I was talking to Dave Buckman about it, who's my boss now, and he's like, you were meant for this job. And I did, I really had some misgivings about it, mostly because, you know, working closely with my good friends is like, that's, that can be difficult.
Indeed.
Yeah. But I did have this moment where I'm like, you will never, ever, ever be again offered a job for which you are so qualified. You know what I mean? Like, this is possibly the only time in your life you're going to get offered a job that you are absolutely, totally qualified to do. And not because I'm a great improviser, but because I really care about improv, and I'd studied a lot, and I had thought about it a lot, you know. Yeah. And I understood how the school worked, and I knew what the issues were. So
yeah, it was like plus middle management.
And plus middle management. Well, that has fortunately worked out great. And I think that's a pretty recent development, because Cold Town went through a long growing period where, you know, it was, and this happens whenever artists start a business, there's just a lot of problems. It was not run in a very business-like way for a long time. And I think all the principals will admit that was the case. It is about a million times better now.
Yeah, I mean, when you start out as artists and then become businessmen is very difficult.
And you're all friends.
Yeah.
Like, that it's is no good. A really rough juggling act.
You should rather be in business with someone you don't like.
Yeah, well, or don't have, yeah.
Don't or don't have spend all your time about. With, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No, there has been a lot of talk of theater management recently in my life.
Sure.
And so
I would imagine.
Just the idea of it and how to come at it and the general, like, okay, let's be honest, this is not exactly like a big growth thing. Like, it's maintaining a community that maybe will get bigger but could also just table at a certain point, because how many people are really in this town? And how recycling can it really happen, you know? So it's interesting to see how, you know, each group handles it, and then how each new person who takes it on, you know, will advertise or look for different things, or even deal with how do I manage the people.
Completely. Well, and you hit on something, you know, modern business, again, not to get political about it, but like modern late capitalism is based on this idea that everything has to keep growing and get bigger all the time. That you have a business, your goal is to grow it.
Yeah.
And I'm always like, the only thing in nature that grows without restraint is cancer. Like, that's not the model you want to use for, you know, that's, I'm sure that's wrong from both an economic and a biological point of view. But
I feel like algae is pretty big.
Yeah, sure. Okay, fair enough. Or hydrilla or whatever. But I do think you're right that when you're doing a theater like that, when you're doing an improv theater, nobody starts one of those for the money.
Yeah, you know? You can't.
So it is this balancing act between community. And if you make it too much a clubhouse where it's just everyone hanging out, then you're kind of selling people short to the extent that they expect some level of professionalism in the shows and the classes. But then if you go too far in the other direction, you're like, no, we're going to be hard asses about everything. It's like, well, why are you in this business? Like, you're not going to make money, so what's the point of being a jerk about it?
Yeah.
But that is, I do think it's a challenge, and I think it's people react more, I think, to changes and impositions of policy and structure in an improv theater because they're so personally invested in it. They take it personally. So when you put in a policy that's like, well, you've got to come to six of your eight classes to move on to the next level. People are like, don't you care about the individual students that are affected by this? It's like, yeah, I do. But that's also a reasonable policy.
Don't you care about the individual students? You're like, really, too?
Well, I do, but I do care
I
about
it. I hate to, but what are you going to do?
No, but, you know, people, the and this is the way Cold Town used to be run, was, oh, this individual has a person has a problem. Well, let's fix their problem and not worry about the underlying structural issues that caused that problem.
Right.
And sooner or later, you have to get to the point, it's like, we have a policy, and yes, sometimes that's not going to be great for an individual person. It's not because we don't like that person or don't care about them. It's just that's we have to run things in a consistent way.
Well, not to mention the fact that like I roll my eyes at trying to take care of everybody's problems. If you're the person who's a proper manager, you have to take care of the many, not the individual. And I that's my personal like thing. I'm like, this whole group has to work. I will try to pay attention to each one of the people and try to make sure that they themselves are having some sort of good experience. But if they're not giving to the experience, I'm not interested. And that's actually one of the reasons why, well, I only teach level one because you're in or you're out. And I, in the nature of the sketch show that I run, I invite people in and then let them go as I would like, because I'm like, I want people to be involved in this. If you're not involved, I'm not interested in working with you. Good luck with your other projects. I'm sure there will be plenty to take up your time.
Yeah, and there's also a distinction that I feel like a lot of people don't make. It's like, what is my professional relationship to you, and what is my personal relationship to you?
Yeah.
So I've had some pretty painful experiences dealing with teachers who, for whatever reason, should not have been teaching. But I've gone out of my way to say, look, I'm not mad at you. I this is not about me being angry or upset with you. This is me setting professional standards, right?
Yeah.
I still love you. I still care about you. I want to help you. And you can't teach right now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like that is two completely different things. But I think we've gotten, and this is probably just generally true all the time, it feels like it's been exaggerated in the era of Facebook, but I feel like people are less and less able to distinguish between this is what I want and this is what should happen. You know? It's like, however I feel about things is actually how it is, and it's how things should go. And it's like, it's two different things. This is how I feel about it, and this is what's actually going to happen.
Yeah, I think that that's actually true on a much larger scale. That is... The idea of that is giving me pause, because it's like, I think you're right. In the world where we have a voice such that, like on social media, we can say our feelings out there, and it's important for everyone to share their feelings, so say society. And and because of these great feeling sharings that we've had lately, we are improving our society. And yes, that is true of many situations. Talking about it will help, gets it out there, great. But I don't know. I think you're right. Sometimes there needs to be some sort of like, but this is the way that it has to be run, and you have to deal with it. Well, like, yeah, it might not be fun for you, but you have to do X, Y, and Z to get what your dream is.
And that's a really fraught idea coming from a straight, middle-class white man. Because that phrase, this is how it's done, was used to marginalize people, has been and continues to be used to marginalize people. You're not doing this right, you know?
Sure.
So I understand why people have a visceral reaction to that, but also an intelligent analytical reaction to that, which is like, you're just privileging the way you want to do things over the way we want to do things. So there's a legitimate response to that. But if you're doing art, at some point, I feel like, if you're serious about it, you gotta have standards. They may be different from someone else's. But I feel like, sometimes I feel like I'm not the only person. I feel like I'm the only person who can distinguish between, I really like that, and I think that's good. You know what I mean? I'm perfectly capable of hearing a song and going, man, I love that, that makes me feel really good. That is a terrible song. Like, you know, as a musician, I'm like, that's awful.
Yeah.
That's terrible. But I love it.
Yeah.
And I don't have any problem with a distinction between that. And I feel like that distinction has been broken down. And maybe, you know, I'm fully willing to acknowledge, like, this idea of standards. Maybe that's outdated. Maybe postmodernism killed that, and that's ridiculous. And it's me imposing, you know, old culture on new people. But I still feel that way. I still feel it's like, yeah, there's things that I recognize that are structurally important to me, either politically or artistically, whatever. And then there's things that I like that I can't help it. I just like them.
Well, there's also this idea that it's like, if you don't like how a business is run, or if you don't like the way something is, do it yourself. There's plenty. Go ahead and do it. Like, and in fact, that is the case of many people's lessons of why they don't want to do it. You know, they'll go, well, I feel like, and then they learn there's difficulty and you have to make choices that, you know, nobody wants to make and say things to people when you're the person in charge that, you know, other people don't want to say or hear. And it's like, I'm super sorry. And then they try it and they're like, oh, no.
Well, here's what's going on, too. That's definitely part of it, what you just said. Here's the other thing. When that person has a problem, it's a real problem. I'm not talking about people who are just complaining for the sake of complaining. I'm talking about someone who has a legitimate concern. They brought it up. That's all they're thinking of. And you, if you're dealing with that problem managerially, that is one of about 1,000 things that you're thinking of, and you're balancing them.
Yeah.
They're all important, and they all you. That's not your main thing. And so, like, the phrase, no manager likes hearing is any question that starts with, why don't you just, and it's like, stop right there. Because if you think there's some easy solution to this that we were just too dumb to have thought of, occasionally you'll be right. But most of the time, we have thought of it, and either we don't have the resources, or there's a reason we can't do that.
You know?
But you're not thinking about the rest of the stuff. You're thinking about, like, oh, there's an obvious solution to this. It's like, there would be. If we had infinite resources to apply to this problem and we didn't have to worry about anything else, that would be the solution.
Yeah. It is fascinating, too. I mean, I feel like that's a lot of what people are doing on social media, too, is just putting out their opinions on how other people should be living their lives or how businesses should be run when they themselves are not being taking part in it, which is can be difficult. But
that someone pushed my buttons recently is a friend of mine, and I like her a lot and I respect her, and she's really smart and she's very politically engaged. But when that the Austin City Council voted on the paid sick leave ordinance, I don't know if you followed that, but that was like, there was a battle over that. And the battle wasn't between, I mean, it's true there were corporate interests, but locally the battle was between, you know, progressive activist groups and local small businesses. It wasn't McDonald's that was fighting this. It was like local small businesses. They're like, this is going to be really hard for us.
Yeah.
And so there was this list leaked out, and there was, I think maybe it was an inaccurate list anyway, but this list leaked out of all the local businesses that were opposed to this. And this friend of mine posted it and said, you know, if you work for one of these businesses, your boss sucks. I was like, look, I supported that ordinance. I worked to make sure it went through. I think it probably won't affect these businesses. I think they'll discover that they can live with it. I think, but I'm like, that's so reductionist to say these people suck because they made a decision that this is probably not in their business's best interest. And, you know, I guess that makes me sound like an apologist for corporate thinking, but I'm like, this whole thing about, like, there's a binary line, and if you're on my side of it, you're absolutely right, and I support everything you do, and if you're on the wrong side of it, you're wrong and bad, and you suck, and there's no defending your position. And I feel like everything has turned into that.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in the world these days. But I feel like I've let us down a negative spiral, and I want to bring us back to to improv. And stuff that you've learned previous to your current lovely, wonderful job at Cold Town.
It is. It's a great job. I love
I'm sure
job.
It is. No, it was my fault. I let us down a negative management trail.
That's all true.
But as far as, like, any, when you started taking courses, you've mentioned that you've taken workshops in other cities.
Yeah.
Tell me about an experience in another city you had that was great or that changed the way you looked at things, perhaps a suggestion of a workshop that people could go to or something like that.
Well, the most formative experience I had, I was less than a year into it, and I went up to I.O. in Chicago for the summer intensive. It's 5 weeks long. And it's hard for me to separate out how much of that was because it was great, because parts of it were definitely objectively great. Part of it was just as it was at the right moment for me. And at that time, we did not have a particularly deep bench of performers here in Austin. you know? Most of the people who were doing it had not been doing it that long. So everyone was, you know, working hard and trying to do good work. But there's a difference between a scene where most people have been doing it for 2 years and a scene where some people have been doing it for 20 years. You know what I mean? It's just the level, the quality of the work is different. So going up there and doing improv for 6 to 7 hours a day and then watching it for 3 to 4 hours at night blew my mind. Completely blew my mind. I kept seeing and learning things that I had never encountered before. I had one of my weeks up there was with Liz Allen, who I literally only had for 4 days, but she remains one of the most influential teachers I've ever had. She was amazing, and she embodied the kind of improv I want to do, which is about finding the truth in something, which is about being willing to be emotionally vulnerable on stage, which is about, yes, we're doing comedy, but we don't have to ignore the entire other range of human emotions in order to do that, and about unconditional support of who you're working with. So that was really, and it, I'd already been, people were teaching me that at Coal Town, because like most of the teachers at Coal Town had trained in a similar vein. But just to have so much of it concentrated up there at one time. And I've had other students go up there, even though they're coming from a scene, you know, Austin now is a much more vibrant scene, and you can see a lot more really great work here. We've got a lot more good teachers here now. They still had a really good experience doing that. So that was something, you know, but obviously that is a difficult thing to afford in terms of time and money. I happened to be a freelancer at that time, and I happened to have the time available, and I saw that the workshop was available, and I think it cost, I don't know, I want to say it cost like $1,000. I'm like, man, if I ever get $1,000, that's what I'm going to do. And literally the next week, I got $1,000 windfall. I don't even remember what it was. But I'm like, yep, I know what I'm doing with that. So it was everything lined up for me.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, out-of-town workshops are great. Intensives are great. Austin's got a lot of really good teachers now.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
So it's like there's this idea that there's some magic bullet elsewhere. There are really great teachers at other schools. There's also teachers at other schools who are perfectly fine, but they're not that much better than, or even better at all than some teachers in Austin. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's a different... We are an improv city now in a way that we weren't when I first started out.
So. Oh, 100%. Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely a destination place for sure.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of different things to offer. Like we were talking about earlier about how it's like, if you're looking for narrative improv, go to the Hideout. If you're looking for, you know, working on musical improv, Shana Merlin's going to help you.
That's
like,
right. That's
like
right.
There are, and the beauty of that is that the sort of overall... Like, how do we provide what the audience, by audience I mean the people who are going to take these classes, how do we give them more? And I feel like there's a lot of people working towards that, and I feel really excited for the, even the crop of people that live here full time to get better and better, so that people can come here more often. To learn from what is a very supportive community.
And the same thing that's a little bit of a downside, it's like, well, you know, it's a community in the process still of creating itself, right? There's some upsides to that.
Yeah.
There's a lot more opportunities to play here than there are, you know, Chicago or New York or LA or places like that. So it's like there's definitely a sense of like, you know what it reminds me a lot of, and this is just my own personal... based on my personal history, but the improv scene over the last 10 years here reminds me so much of the Austin music scene in the 80s. Because it's like...
Aww.
Because it went from everybody knows everybody and hangs out at the same couple of places and everyone's supportive even though they're technically in competition, you know, to this really rich scene that is big enough now that it's kind of impossible to know everybody. You know, it's
I accept like really the future of our richness.
Yeah, exactly.
I will put in the time if it means someday there'll be a statue of one of us on a street downtown, and they'll call it Willie Nelson. Wait, I mean, Our Name Avenue.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, sure, I'll take it.
It'll be the only time an improviser has ever gotten famous for doing improv if there's a statue.
Yeah, that can be wild. One last question, and then I will let you off to enjoy this rainy day.
Uh-huh.
In your experience teaching, is there a moment that you can think of, or a lesson that you feel like it's important, either a lesson you love to impart to people, or a story of a good experience teaching, something that you've had a good experience, you've enjoyed, or you feel like you've imparted some wisdom while you were teaching here in Austin?
I think to the extent that I have imparted any wisdom as a teacher, it springs directly from, I mean, obviously I'm transmitting a lot of useful information that I was taught by good teachers in turn.
Yeah.
But to the extent that I'm bringing anything of myself to it, I think a lot of it goes back to how much I struggled as a student. And I was, so this gets back to something you were talking about earlier, I was a terrible student.
Oh yeah, tell me that story.
So here's the thing, I was older. Older students struggle more.
Yeah.
And I for a while I thought, well, you're just saying that because you were an older student and you struggled. That doesn't follow. I've had enough of them now. Mm-hmm. It's hard. We're rewiring our brains. You got a 40-year-old and a 20-year-old in the same class. One person has literally been forging their neural pathways for twice as long as the other person. It's going to be harder to break out of that stuff. But I was also arrogant. And I thought I knew better than everybody else. And I thought I didn't need this unconditional support bullshit. That was for simps.
I get that a lot.
I was a mess. And I also couldn't agree to anything. All my early teachers were like, Radliff, just agree with something, anything, you know? And it took me years to get out of that. But because of that, I feel like what I understand is that none of that was done with malicious intent. I was trying really hard. I wanted to be good at this. I wanted to be supportive, and it was really hard for me. So the lesson I took from that is, and it's really hard if you're a teacher to do this, because you've got some people that are just, they're more fun to teach than other people. But when you have someone who's being difficult and someone who is seems like they're resisting you and they're hard to deal with, they're doing the best they can. And I feel like my job as a teacher is to meet them where they are, even if they're not doing what I want them to do, like is to deal with them the best I can. And I don't know. I think that's it. And I think there's different philosophies about it. I think if you've decided that your school is a professional training center and your only job is to turn out top quality improvisers, that's kind of a different deal. That's kind of like, you can afford to be a hard ass and you can afford to write people off and say, you don't belong here. That's not how I view it. I think it's one thing we do, but we've had students who come in, and they came in because they were painfully shy and they just wanted to address that. And by the time they graduate, they're doing shows and they're loving doing shows. Are they ever going to be professional improvisers? Maybe not. But I consider them to be wins, you know, because based on who they were when they came in, we worked with them, we didn't blow them off, we didn't say you're not good enough, beat it, we worked with them, right? So that, I think, is the main thing I took. Is like, I want to help, if you're willing to do the work, I want to help you regardless of where you started at. And that's one thing I try to get all teachers to do, and different people do it with different skill sets, but that's kind of important.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Sure, thank you.
For sitting down with me and chatting and dealing with my wild baby who is bouncing around, yelling and screaming.
This is a very well-behaved child.
Oh, good. Okay. He's just hungry. Yes, he is. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.
Your time is valuable. And I hope you have a wonderful day.
You too.
Doing the things
thank
that
you
you're doing.
Thank you for inviting me.
And thank you for being sweet to him and letting him chew your fingers.
He's a very sweet boy.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast.